Hello, everybody. You're listening to Standard Reason on the radio and the World Wide Web.
Are you sure it's legal?
All right, friends, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and so glad you joined me today. We've got 2 hours ahead of us of careful thinking about critical issues, and one of my pals and mentors to help us do that the first hour, and I've been looking forward to this interview for a while. Dr. J.P. Moreland is my guest, and of course you know him as the founder of the Influential Master's Program at Philosophy of Religion and Ethics at Talbot School of Theology, of which I am a graduate, and so is the Enforcer, and we have a couple of other Stand to Reason staffers currently enrolled for earned degrees in chemistry, philosophy, and theology, PhD from USC in philosophy, and more important than all of that is he's the guy who's had probably more influence in my life as a Christian thinker than anyone else. And Jay, I just found out you have a new woman in your life, or should I say little woman in your life.
Yes, I have a precious little granddaughter that was born June 2nd. In fact, I'm looking at her right now. Her name is Taylor May Brady.
All right. Good for you.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Hey, Greg, I was in Kansas City a week ago
at
a conference, and I ran across a man from another part of the country who told me that your radio show and then the Stand to Reason website and the materials available has changed his life.
No kidding.
I'm not kidding. He said, "Do you know Greg Kokel?" And I said, "Well, I try not to admit that, but yes, I do." and he just couldn't stop talking about how much the program and also the materials made available has helped him. And I just wanted to pass that on.
Well, thank you. And I hope you take that as a kind of sideways compliment, because the comment I made a few moments ago, you've heard me make it before, and it's you just had a tremendous influence, not in my life, but the Enforcers, Melinda Penner, and the Stand to Reason legacy, really, the whole thing kind of stands on your shoulders in a great way, so we're indebted to you.
Well, thank you, Greg.
By the way, just as another little curiosity, I noticed in the packet that came with the book of yours that we're discussing today, Kingdom Triangle, you have a citation here from Lance Pitlick, senior pastor of the Vineyard Church in Anaheim. He's your pastor, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Did you know that Lance and I spent like 3 months together driving in a car with two other people all over Europe and Eastern Europe in 1976?
It is a small world.
Really small. He had just gotten out of seminary over at Fuller, and we got packed in together in a project. There were just four of us, and we worked. We were in five different communist countries, and Lance and I were shoulder to shoulder for 3.5 months, and it's great to see what God has been doing in his life.
Well, you mentioned that. He didn't say it long, but he said that he'd been on a long trip with you. And
he would have said, "I've been on a long, long, long trip with Greg Kokel." What we're here to talk about is a book that you characterize as kind of your, I don't know if it's exactly the magnum opus, but it's the work that you've been really wanting to write all your life.
Yes.
And that's Kingdom Triangle with Zondervan Publishers. Recover the Christian mind, renovate the soul, restore the spirit's power. And there's a sense in which, and of course we've talked about a lot of your books on the show.
Yes.
As they keep coming up, we just have you on. And it's like these are all topics you've touched on in some measure in virtually everything else that you've written.
Yeah, this book I think really brings together 38 years of ministry. And I've tried to write the book in a way that is very readable. I mean, some of my books are challenging, but this one is by far the most readable and has the broadest audience of any book I've written. And the feedback I'm getting already is that it's beginning to have a good reception and an impact out there. Mm-hmm. So I'm encouraged.
Well, that's good, because you actually spend some time to talk about a problem and then you talk about a solution. And before we get into the particulars, though, there's a question I want to ask you that's been rolling around in my mind. In fact, I have an opinion about it and I've been sharing it with audiences, but I just wanted to get your take on it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be captured in a comment that you made on page 38, which is Christians today need a lot more courage and confidence that what they offer have to offer is true, reasonable, and critical for a wide range of issues in the center of the public square. And as I look around, I've been friends with you over 20 years now, and so we've kind of shoulder to shoulder in one sense or another working with this stuff.
Yes,
but it seems to me in the last 3 or 4, maybe 5 years, there's just a convergence of factors, in my opinion, that have made things a lot more difficult for Christians in the public square, at least in the West, and especially in the United States. You got the new atheists, the Daniel Dennett's and the Christopher Hitchens now, and the Sam Harris's and the you know that crowd.
Right.
And then you've got, and which is ironic because it seemed like the big problem on the horizon was the postmodern crowd, and all of a sudden these modernists, these Enlightenment modernists, hit, you know, blindside us from the other side. They come out of nowhere and they hit the bestseller list. And do you think it's getting harder for us as thinking Christians to really to navigate in the world? Is the ante going up?
Yeah, it is. The ante is going up. I think you're absolutely right. But I think there's a reason for it. And I think it's because the other side is threatened. And I don't say that in a self-serving way. But look, the truth is that, as you pointed out, for 20 years, there has been a revolution been taking place in the evangelical community.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the kinds of venues that are available today, Stand to Reason is a classic example, but there are others out there.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look at the literature and the people who are defending the faith and pushing the case for Christ in new and powerful ways. This is more widespread, and it's at the highest levels now than any time in the 40 years I've been
mm-hmm.
in ministry.
Don't look at Philosophia Christi, for example.
Absolutely. That's just another classic example. And I think what's happened, I mean, Greg, the intelligent design movement
mm-hmm.
is so powerful, and it's far more powerful than anything that came before the late 80s.
Right, right.
Well, what we're now getting is a shrill backlash,
mm-hmm.
and it's not that there's anything new in these books.
That's right.
It's not like we're, oh, my gosh, you know, we never thought of that.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe the attitude is a little bit new,
right,
in a sense.
That's exactly right. And we're getting a shrill, kind of demeaning, ignorant critique, to be honest with
mm-hmm.
you. And that tells me that we've got their attention. So
mm-hmm.
I think it is getting more difficult, but I think it's because there are people that are being made nervous by the increased quality of Christian thought in this area.
Yeah, I mentioned Philosophia Christi. That's the number one journal in philosophy of religion in the world, and it comes right out of Talbot.
You know? And it's a great journal.
It is. It's sensational. So what do you think about the impact of 9/11 in this whole enterprise, though? I won't poison the well. You tell me what do you think that that's helped change the tenor of the conversation?
I do. Yeah, I sure do. I think initially, the attack on 9/11 got absolutism back on the table.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard to say that what they did wasn't evil initially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think that's faded away, and what has now happened is that the Muslim terrorism has given these modernist atheists an excuse to lump us all together.
Yeah, all the fundamentalists are the same.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
and we're all irrational idiots that are in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely the kind of thing you would expect from people who can't think clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Because the person who will think well is a person who makes distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows a lack of familiarity with the differences in the intellectual rigor of these communities to
right.
lump them together. But
right.
I think that's what I see. What do you see about it?
Yeah, I think the same thing. All of a sudden, all fundamentalists are bad. I actually think there's a kind of an odd irony about this, JP, and that is that it took a Muslim attack on this country to cost 3,000 dead Americans overnight to make Islam the religion with most favored religious status in this country, and all evangelical read fundamentalist Christians to be total personas non grata.
Yeah.
It's like, how did that happen? How do these guys get special treatment now? Because you can't say anything bad about them now. You know, you're
not
cut off immediately. But bad guys are guys like you and I. So,
right, exactly.
But so you're kind of saying, well, that's kind of a reason to rejoice in a way, because if we weren't making an impact, they wouldn't be squealing.
Absolutely. I've seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of thing happened in the late 60s. And right at the beginning of the 70s, and then it died down, and it's coming back now. And there's no question in my mind that that this is because of an intimidation, fear, and one characteristic is the fact that the rhetoric is shrill and demeaning.
Right.
That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the case that they're making is both overstated and shows almost no familiarity with the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a tip-off to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I think this is going to backfire on them long haul. But I think I actually am strengthened by it, tell the truth.
Well, this kind of all touches on the first part of your book where you talk about the problem, assessing the crisis of our age, and you talk about the hunger for drama in a thin world. Now, that's a catchy chapter title, JP. Tell me, the hunger for drama in a thin world. I'm familiar with the concept of the empty selves, which you pursue here a little bit. It's been part of your other books as well, but I suspect that ties into the concept of thin world. Why don't you bring us up on those concepts?
Well, you can't have drama if there's nothing that's dramatic. And if there is no God, nothing can be dramatic because there is no ultimate meaning to life.
In other words, dramatic in the sense that something genuine is at stake, there's deep
exactly.
meaning.
So in the chapter, I distinguish between thin worlds and thick worlds. In a thin world, if you just think of a world as a possible way that things could have been, I mean, if you take a thin world, that's an atheistic world because that's a world where nothing ultimately matters, there's no ultimate value, there's no life after death, we weren't put here for a purpose.
Molecules in motion.
Right. And so you can't have drama in a world like that. You can only have entertainment. There can't be heroes. There can only be celebrities. And so that's because nothing rises to the level of being hugely important in a world where you're going to have your 4 score and 10 and then you die and you're 6 feet under. A thick world is a world where things matter. Now, if Islam were true, then we would live in a thick world.
Right.
Things would really matter, though I don't think Islam's not true. But Christianity is a thick world because we believe that we were here for a purpose and so on. So I think everyone deep down hungers to be a part of something dramatic. But because we live in a postmodern and a naturalistic culture, a lot of people don't have a worldview that makes sense out of their own life being dramatic, and so they have to live vicariously through trivializing insignificant making important trivial events like Super Bowl or sports, which I love. I'm not against that. But then people that live vicariously through Britney Spears or through movies or through sports in order to gain some vicarious excitement in their life because their own life is boring. And I think that the impact of naturalism and postmodernism on the culture is to cause people's lives to feel boring to them and to deaden them. And so if I'm right about that, then what we would see in a culture where naturalism and postmodernism are pervasive is we would see more addiction because people would be having to escape their quote-unquote boring lives and to get a sense of adrenalization and drama from chemicals or sex or movie stars or what have you. And so to summarize then, I think that the people's hunger for drama through trivial means tells us two things. Number one, we really were made for drama, and we can't escape that even if we try to.
That's kind of Lewis's argument from Desire.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
which
was very powerful in his own conversion.
It's a powerful argument.
Yeah.
And number two, that our culture isn't meeting that need. And so there's something wrong at the level of worldview. That's what I try to unpack in that first chapter.
I think of somebody like a Christopher Hitchens, and you've probably gotten a little familiarized with his recent book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. It turns out he's a moral realist.
Exactly.
He's not a moral non-realist, like a moral relativist, like a lot of these materialists. He's actually a moral realist, and so it's almost as if he wants to have a worldview. He's committed to a worldview that results in a thin world, but he wants to hitchhike upon the goods of a thick world like morality,
right?
Which he knows he can't really get away from, but he doesn't want to attribute that to its source in God. He still wants to deny God.
And that's why that's what happens when a person doesn't think pervasively, but only piecemeal. What you have is a person who just is thinking in a piecemeal fashion. In other words, I'm just going to think about my ethics right now. Okay, now tomorrow I'm going to think about my evolutionary theory. I'm not going to put them together.
Yeah, there's no coherence.
Yeah, they don't think
right.
They don't think synthetically. They're split off. They're isolated. They have seven or eight little areas that they think in, and they don't try to put them together. I know of a famous philosopher. I'm not going to mention his name. He's not a believer. He's one of the top philosophers in the country, teaches at an Ivy League school, who told a former student of mine that he doesn't try to integrate his philosophy of mind, and he's a strict materialist, with his philosophy of freedom and agency. He just has never tried to integrate the two. He works out his theory of human freedom and action and his theory of mind totally separate from one another because he has no drive to integrate them. That's what I think is happening.
Well, there also is he's committed to materialism, and he is deeply aware of his own libertarian freedom, and there is no possibility of integrating those two things, and so he can just ignore it.
And that's right. Because, I mean, I'd like to ask, you know, okay, given your view of how everything got here, how did these moral values arise?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should have some answer on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be a very good one.
Yeah. Well, you have two other chapters, and following this description of the drama in Thin World, which is a great, I think, foil for laying out how you proceed in the book, you have two competing stories here that you talk about that are really the main counterfeit players to Christianity here, and they're in the sense to me they're kind of oddly opposites, or they work against each other, but they kind of land on the same place. You know, when the dust settles, they're in bed with each other in a certain way. Does that make sense?
Right.
Does that description make sense to you?
Oh, it's completely accurate.
Go ahead and tell us about the two competing stories.
Well, the fundamental story that we're taught in our mother's knee is the naturalist story, and that is that there was a Big Bang. Don't ask how that happened. We have atoms and molecules that form chemical elements and planets and galaxies, and then eventually we evolved on one of the little specks of dust called Earth, and everything can be explained by science, and the physical world is really all there is. And that story is bereft of value because you can't make sense out of how you can get an ought from an is if you have things that simply are the case. According to the laws of nature, you can't all of a sudden explain how you could get something that ought to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
So the naturalist story is one thing, and it limits knowledge to what we can sense with our five senses and to the hard sciences. So if you can't measure it and test it in chemistry and physics, you can't know it.
So if it ain't scientific, it ain't true kind of thing. It's just
right.
Just part of your imagination. We're up against a break here, JP, but that's half of the alternate stories that are competing for the Christian worldview here, the naturalist story. Maybe when we come back, you can go into a little more detail on that, and we'll get into the, in a sense, the ugly stepsister, which is at the other end of the spectrum, but they're both in bed together, postmodernism. When we return, my guest, Dr. J.P. Moreland, a regular to this program, a great friend of mine and Stand to Reasons, and his new book is Kingdom Triangle, and he's taking all the work of the many years and kind of pulling it together in one cover to help accomplish a revolution in thinking in Christianity. We'll be back with more of J.P. Moreland in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador, and to open up the riches of truth in new ways, and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And I know this is a song that you remember, JP. Do you like the 60s music and the early 70s stuff, Jay?
In fact, I was sitting here singing. I love ointments.
My guest, JP Moreland, longtime friend of Stand to Reasons and author of Kingdom Triangle, Recover the Christian Mind, Renovate the Soul, and Restore the Spirit's Power. Although it sounds like 3 points of the triangle there. In the subtitle of your book, we're talking right now about the crisis of our age. Incidentally, just a reminder for the rest listening, Jay, you're going to be one of our featured speakers on our cruise.
Yeah, you bet.
Coming up next, it's about a year. I guess it's, I don't know if it's July or August, what the date is, but you'll be on in our cruise, no way, to Alaska, and the itinerary is just a skosh different. We pick up a different city than we did last time around. I think we go up to where the Gold Rush stuff was, and so that's going to be a lot of fun. We look forward to another good time with you. Josh McDowell is going to be on board, too, as one of our speakers. His son, Sean McDowell, will be there. I don't know what I'm going to do, to be honest with you. I think
Why don't you enjoy the scenery?
Hey, all right, that sounds like a good idea. So, of course, JP is the founder of the Master's Program of Philosophy, Religion, and Ethics at Talbot School of Theology, and the Enforcer and I both graduated from there. Melinda was just in the studio, JP, and you know, she does the lion's share of the blogging for Stand to Reason, does a superb job as authoring one of the top Christian blogs in the blogosphere.
Right.
And she mentioned to me that the reason that she's improved so much over the years is because she had to write so many praises for the philosophy program, you know, those short, tight summaries of things. And you get right to the point. It's good for blogging and for careful thinking, getting in the exercise of doing that kind of thing.
Well, in fact, there were two or three praises that she never turned in.
You
might want to talk to the enforcer about that before we're finished here.
Well, she's really good at it now. She'll probably knock it off in a few hours there, or maybe she'll just turn in some of her blogs and ask that'll work. And this program is doing so well. You got a waiting list now, as I understand it. Is that right, Jay?
Absolutely.
The master's program.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's doing very, very well. And it's been very exciting, you bet.
We started out talking about the crisis of our age, and we talked about two conflicting stories that the Christian account of the world and reality is now currently competing with. And that's the natural story instead of the naturalist story. Instead of in the beginning God, it was in the beginning of the particles.
That's right.
But then you've got this other story that's kind of you know, it's like I call it the ugly stepsister, because it's only kin in that it arrives at the same place, but it does do through a very different means. Tell us about that.
Well, the postmodern story says in the beginning was whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the basic idea for really thoroughgoing and thoughtful postmodernists is that all truth, all reality, all value is completely a construction of your culture. Mm-hmm. And so what we have is postmodernism flourishing in the arts and literature and the humanities and pop culture. And it's, you know, we have our truth, you have your truth, and there's no one wrong. Everybody has their truth.
Whatever.
And exactly. Mm-hmm. And so these movements, as you pointed out, don't agree about a lot of things, but there is one thing they do agree about, and that's that there is no such thing as knowledge outside the hard sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And so this raises a question for Christians, and it's not just, is Christianity true, but as important, can it be known to be true?
Mm-hmm.
And see, a lot of people would be willing to grant that maybe there is a God or maybe Christianity is true, but you sure can't know that,
mm-hmm.
so just your opinion. And the church has always believed that in Scripture and in knowledge, in the knowledge of God through nature and so on, that she was in possession of a body of knowledge about reality and not just a body of truths that had to be accepted by an act of choice or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So to tell you the truth, Greg, in the first half of the book, what my real goal in Kingdom Triangle is twofold. Number one, I'm trying to empower Christians to be able to see what they don't normally see when they watch the news or listen to the radio
mm-hmm.
and at a worldview level. And secondly, I want to increase their confidence that what we have in Christianity is honestly, no kidding, at the very root of what people need today, whether they know it or not.
Mm-hmm. The truth.
I was in the
most robust
knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge of truth.
Right,
I was
right.
At Seattle Airport years ago. I mentioned this in the book. And I read the Seattle Times, and there was an editorial on the front page of the editorial that said that we're the most divided country in the history of our nation since the Civil War. And the division isn't fundamentally political or economic, it's fundamentally a worldview issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with Bill O'Reilly in his book, Culture Warrior, where he basically says the same thing, that the fundamental division is between secular progressives, people who are secular, and I would count naturalists and strict postmodernists in that category,
mm-hmm.
and what he calls traditionalists, and or what I would call ethical monotheists, of which Christianity is the most vibrant form.
Right.
So what encourages me is that more and more people are coming to see that the debate today isn't first and foremost political or economic or ethnic or racial,
mm-hmm.
but it is at its very bottom a worldview issue. And that means then that those of us, especially ministries like Stand to Reason, that teach people to think worldviewishly are actually doing a more fundamental job of importance than Fox News or folk that tend to leave the analysis at the level of the political.
Mm-hmm. Well, this kind of leads into the last thing I wanted to mention before we actually go into the solution itself, the triangle, and that is you have a chapter on, it's entitled From Drama to Deadness in Five Steps, and so how we've kind of lost the original sense of drama. You know, the pre-Enlightenment, you know, God wasn't kicked out of the world.
Right.
He was still in the game in some sense, and in the Enlightenment, then he's out of the picture, and this then has results in five different steps. You've already begun to talk about the first one, the issue of knowledge and kind of a blind leap of faith.
Yeah, we've shifted from knowledge to a blind leap of faith in three areas: religion, ethics, and politics.
Mm.
So that in when we're dealing with something outside chemistry and physics, which turns out to be almost everything that matters to us, the makeup man is more important than the speechwriter.
Mm-hmm.
That it's image and impression rather than careful reflection about in political or ethical or religious issues. We've shifted from a classic view of freedom to a contemporary view. The classic view of freedom is that I'm free if I have the power to do what I ought to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that means I'm free to play the piano if I've spent years learning the nature of a piano and I've submitted myself to the nature and the truth about the piano itself.
Mm-hmm.
I personally am not free to play the piano because I know nothing about it. So on the classic view of freedom, freedom actually requires submission to truth and knowledge
right.
about the object.
My on the door of my 25-year-old son, we have a quote from J.P. Moreland, and it says, "You will never amount to anything in life unless you habitually learn to do the things you don't like to do."
Yeah, well, and that's...
That's right at the heart of what you're talking
that's
about.
That's right at the gut of it, you bet.
And I hate reading that thing because there are all kinds of things I don't want to do, but, you know, it helps
right.
me apply myself.
Well,
the way I ought
and
to.
You don't have to in the contemporary view of freedom because
mm-hmm.
the contemporary view of freedom is I get to do anything I want.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that you're a free agent and you don't have to submit to reality. You can do what you want to do. And unfortunately, that shift from the power to do what I ought. I mean, think of a father. What father is really free? The man who has learned to have the power to do what he ought to do as a father
mm-hmm.
and as a husband, or a man who says, I've got the right to do what I want to do.
I'm out of here. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to play with you. I want to read the paper. Now,
mm-hmm.
there's room for that, but you understand the point.
Yes, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge shift, and it's not been a positive one.
What about the shift from duty and virtue to kind of
yeah.
a minimalist kind of ethic?
Well, this is huge in the abortion debate because what we've done is that we've shifted from a view of the moral life as one that involves what are my duties And what is a virtuous person, and how do I become one? Mm-hmm. Two, rights. What are my rights?
Mm-hmm.
Now, see, the previous standpoint requires that there be non-empirical knowledge. You'd have to have knowledge of ethics to be able to know what are the right duties and mm-hmm. which ones aren't the right duties, and what is a virtuous person.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to be a good dad or a mother, I would have to know what are some of the characteristics that are true of a good mother, and how can I become that? But today, the idea is rights. And so take the abortion debate. Now, by the way, rights are important, but they don't form the core of the moral
mm-hmm.
life. Duty and virtue do. So here I am. I'm deciding whether I want to get an abortion.
In fact, rights follow from duty and virtue, it
absolutely.
Seems to me.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And
you've
so,
have the first.
In the old view, a woman would say, what would be the virtuous thing to do, and what would be the thing that would allow me to do my duty to the community, to myself, to my
unborn child.
Child, and so on. But today it's, what is my right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge shift.
Mm-hmm.
The shift I'm trying to point out, though, is, before we go to break here, is that the old view required there to be knowledge of ethics and virtue. The new one doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we actually have a few more minutes. We can get right into the triangle now. So you have a way out of this, and as we get a clear grasp of grasp of the issues here, what the problem is, then you start building a foundation of the way that an individual Christian can grow in a balanced way, in the ways that are necessary for them to be the kinds of ambassadors that can make changes in these areas. So why don't you give us kind of an introductory layout of that, and then we'll get more detail when we come back from the break.
Well, what I did, Greg, is I did a pretty detailed study of the Book of Acts and the first four centuries of the church, and I interviewed some church history experts during that time period, and I identified three central things that were part of the church's self-understanding for at least 400 years,
mm-hmm.
and they were what the church thought she had to be about to produce an alternative revolutionary movement to the culture. And the first was...
And that's what you're after here. I mean, you're very upfront about that in your
material. We're countercultural. You know, that doesn't mean I don't go to restaurants and enjoy movies. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we're countercultural.
Mm-hmm.
We don't fit in. We're weird. We're different, and we ought to be different. And the early church was. And I tell people, you've heard me say this before, they were so stinking different that today we name our children Peter and Paul and our dogs Caesar and Nero. And I
right.
just love that.
Uh-huh.
And so the first was the recovery is the emphasis that in Christ we have knowledge of God, knowledge of the spiritual world, knowledge of reality. We have a worldview that is rational, it makes sense, all that. The second is the ability to cultivate a tender heart and a transformed inner life, including the affections and the emotions. And this involves spiritual formation. It involves learning to invite the Lord to search your heart and to feel a tenderness toward Him. And then the third is the power of the gospel and the power of God, and the power of the kingdom and the power of the Holy Spirit to deal with the demonic and for God to speak and guide us and to even heal and heal the sick. And
mm-hmm.
I think those are three things. And if one of them gets out of balance, the other two,
mm-hmm.
I think, could be in trouble. You need all three to have a balanced church and Christian life, I think.
You know, we talked about your last book here, I think the last time we talked, and on the air at least, and
right.
that was the...
Lost Virtue of Happiness.
Yes, The Lost Virtue of Happiness.
Perfect.
And you actually spent some time in that book, kind of going over some very practical steps that had to do with the things that you can do to, in a sense, begin to apprentice yourself to Jesus Christ, getting your body involved in the process,
right.
Whether it's study or whether it's worship. And these are some things that I have begun to employ in my own life that have been very helpful. There's a lot there, you know, and sometimes I think this progress can be slow for us even when we have a good, a strong intent. Do you find that some people, in a sense, are a little bit more inclined towards the affective side, the emotional side, et cetera, and that comes easier to them and the intellectual is more difficult, and then vice versa?
I absolutely do. And here's the good news. The good news is that we're a body. And while I think we should, in the book, I contend that we should all try to grow a bit in all three of these areas. The most important thing is that our congregations exemplify these. And that means that there will be people in a congregation that are a little bit more leaning toward one as opposed to the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And that's healthy as long as they don't think that the other two legs of the triangle aren't important.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that they think, well, what I'm doing is the only thing that matters. Because we all have different gifts and callings, and we could all certainly grow in our tender affection and in our ability to discern the Lord's guidance and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the real balance comes in the local church and in like parachurch ministries, rather than it having to be in the individual, because we're all going to look different.
In other words, Stand to Reason, for example, as an organization, then serves one aspect of
exactly.
this more. There's more of a focus on it in the local church. I was at a church this morning
right.
in Canyon Country, and what I like to tell pastors, I said, we're here to do some things that you're not equipped to do or you don't have the time to do, but it's something that the local body needs.
Yeah, and that's perfectly legitimate as far as I'm concerned, because you're not claiming that ministries or churches that are trying to bring the other things to bear are somehow out of bounds or not mm-hmm. doing what they should be, but you're saying, I'm going to take a piece of this pie, but
right.
we hope all three of these get done.
Right.
That's the kind of balance I'm talking
about. But you're looking, you're campaigning for balance in the local church, but also in the individual, too, to kind
yeah.
of bring these things. Because I know that, you know, we've talked about this before. For me, the knowledge side it comes easy, naturally. It's kind of what I'm all about. But then the more affective side is something that comes more slowly.
Well,
it's more difficult. And my concern is I want both sides to be properly biblically informed. And I don't want dead orthodoxy on one side. People have all the right answers, but no genuine life.
Right.
On the other hand, I don't want all the life that's not properly biblically informed and then taking people in directions they don't need to go.
And absolutely. And I don't want to look back over the last 2, 3, 4 years of my life and not see things that have happened that I need God to explain, that mm-hmm. were genuinely either specific answers to prayer or people who have something impact them more than you could explain by your own abilities.
Yeah.
So we ought to be seeing things happening where the effect is greater than the human cause.
Right,
That's important.
That's a great way of putting it, too, you know, as we look back. And this is a hard question to ask, you know, because sometimes the answer is not what we wish we had as Christians who are trying to make a difference. You know, hey, what do I have in the past couple years that can't be explained by natural means as a result of God working in my life? So,
right.
We'll get back to that in a minute. We'll talk more detail about the Kingdom Triangle, recovering the Christian mind, renovating the soul. We'll talk about that. Restoring the Spirit's power, lots of interesting stuff that you've uncovered in the book on those issues. When we return from the break, J.P. Moreland is my guest, the book Kingdom Triangle. I'm Greg Kokel, and this is Stand to Reason.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. My guest, J.P. Moreland, and his new book, Kingdom Triangle. And, Jay, this is also from those times, but it's a perfect lyrics for what we're talking about for many people stuck in that thin world that you were talking about. Nowhere, man.
Keep the music going, man. I don't want to listen to me. Let's listen to the music.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting, you know, when I look back just even on the Beatles, how much profundity there was and what in the reflection. Now, they didn't come up with the right answers, but they were certainly in touch with some of this.
You bet.
Some of these things that I think are worthy of reflection for us.
Absolutely. You bet.
And we're talking here about the Kingdom Triangle now and recovering the Christian mind, renovating the soul, and restoring the Spirit's power. You have three sections devoted to each of those. Let's quickly talk about knowledge. It's what we've talked a lot about already, but you have a section on how to strengthen your faith, the nature of faith, and three ways to grow in knowledge,
yep,
in knowledgeable confidence in God and His truth. Go ahead and tell us in summary fashion what you're talking
about. Let me say it briefly. My important point is that Christians come to understand that they don't simply have truth, but they have truth that can actually be known to be true. Mm-hmm. Now, in order for people to feel confident about that...
Wait, tell us the difference here for the sake of some of our listeners who may not be up to speed in this.
A person could have a true belief but not have good, adequate reasons for that belief, and so they would believe the truth, but they wouldn't actually be willing to say they know it.
They got lucky, maybe.
They got lucky.
Yes, yeah.
But if you know something, then you not only have a true belief, but it's based on good and adequate ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do is I spell out for people exactly what knowledge is, and I clear away some confusions. I'll give one of them to you. It's the idea that if you know something, you've got to be 100% certain you're right. And mm-hmm. that's not true. I can cite 5, 6, 7 places in the Bible where it says, I want you to know with certainty such and such. That's like saying, I want you to put pickles on your hamburger. That assumes that you could have a hamburger without pickles, and
mm-hmm.
say, I want you to know with certainty assumes you could know without certainty.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that a person could know that God is real or that there's life after death and still admit they might be mistaken, or they could have that they do have some questions that they don't know how to answer and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So knowledge doesn't mean you have to be so absolutely 100% certain that there's not any possibility you're wrong. And I think if you elevate knowledge too high, then you can hardly know anything.
Can't get off the ground, right.
So I try to clarify that.
Mm-hmm. Three ways to know knowledgeable, to grow in your confidence in His truth? Or just a couple of them, just to move forward here?
Yeah, I think what you do is you if you have specific doubts, you write them down on a sheet of paper. And you doubt your doubts.
Uh-huh.
You try to get answers to them. If you look for reasons.
Uh-huh.
Secondly, if the doubt is a vague, general one, then I think what you do is you think that's probably emotional, or it's probably due to abandonment issues when
yeah.
I was a child.
Sure, sure.
So it's a both and. But I give some ideas like that.
Yeah, okay, those are good. Let's go on to the emotional sensitivity, cultivating that in your soul. You make a statement here that is very provocative. Emotions are terrible masters, but wonderful servants.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
We live in a very cold, dead culture where people are very impersonal and passionless with respect to one another. And so we pass one another on the street, and there's very little feeling. And what we Christians believe in is that a rich life of emotion and feeling. Feelings
mm-hmm.
are important, and people who are into apologetics and philosophy can tend to look down on folk that care a lot about emotion and tenderness and warmth, and
mm-hmm.
they can even call it mysticism.
mm-hmm.
And there's certainly a bad form of mysticism, but there's a good form where you learn to feel God's presence and fall in love with Him. And
this is part of the emphasis of your other book on happiness.
It talked
about techniques and doing that. Right, right.
And I talk about how some techniques for cultivating a tender inner life, and how to learn to meditate in your emotional area, your heart.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, there's one reviewer on Amazon.com that claimed that my teaching on this was New Age mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was sad to me, because just because you use language, or you might even say something that New Age people happen to believe, I assume, for example, that New Age people believe 2 and 2 is 4,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't follow that what you're doing is New Age.
Right, right.
When I talk about...
They're different worldviews.
Yeah, and if the New Age people think it's important to learn to feel in your heart area and to feel what's going on with your deepest emotions, well, mm-hmm. then they're right about that.
Mm-hmm, right.
So, but what I'm doing is I'm recommending some principles that people can run through to get in touch with mm-hmm. that area and to cultivate that, spiritual disciplines, meditative prayer, things like that.
Right.
So here's the bottom line. I would like the listener... to walk away from reading that part with some specific suggestions that they could do to begin to cultivate that and some things to read. And I believe we apologists need to read the Dallas Willards and the Henry Nouwens mm-hmm. and the Richard Fosters. That mm-hmm. doesn't mean we're going to agree with everything they say.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be things we don't like, but mm-hmm. there will also be some good things, and we can benefit from that.
Well, the way I put it, and maybe this is a variation on your citation here, is that the emotions make life delicious, but careful thinking makes life safe. And
oh, sweet. That's...
both are necessary, you know.
I like that.
Good. So maybe it'll show up in your next book. I don't know.
Hey, man, I'm going to put that on my granddaughter's door.
Okay.
That's sweet.
Finally, though, you get into just, you know, an area that a lot of evangelicals are a little uncomfortable with because it
and
sounds
right.
Pentecostal. It's like
right.
supernatural power. And right. this is, you know, we have some differences about some things, but just I'm going on record. I don't have any problem in principle with this
sure.
idea because.
No, you and I are on the same page on that, but we might. But no, I totally agree with you, Greg.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about that, about the expectation of living a supernatural life. And
What I introduce the reader to is the fact that Christianity is exploding worldwide since 1970 in a way that's almost hard to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't go into the details now, but let me just say that, for example, by the year 2020, the Washington Post said not long ago that half of China is going to be born-again Christian if it goes the way it's going.
Mm-hmm.
We are seeing Christianity sweep Africa, South America, Central America, Asia, China. I mean, it's incredible, and it's even regaining ground in Eastern Europe.
Mm.
And what missiologists are telling us is that an awful lot of this has to do with more supernatural phenomena like physical healings.
Mm-hmm.
We have a doctoral program at Biola that trains people in cultural anthropology and missions, and they send doctoral students over to India and other countries to do research in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw one of the reports where one of the graduate students interviewed 20, 30 pastors who were doing work in India, and to a man, they all said that what caused their church to grow was the power of the gospel to heal the sick and to deal with overt demonic manifestations.
Mm-hmm.
These are power cultures. And so what I do in that last part of the book is I acknowledge that there have been terrible abuses about this,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's because the Kingdom Triangle was not in place.
Mm-hmm.
So many people, I'm not Pentecostal or charismatic. I don't have any beef against them. I don't believe in a second baptism, and I'm
mm-hmm.
wrong about that, but that's not my view.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm trying to do, Greg, is I'm trying to make this a kingdom issue, not a spiritual gifts issue.
Right, right.
And I don't think this has anything to do with spiritual gifts. Now,
right.
I believe the gifts are for today, but some of my listeners right now or your listeners might not agree with that. But there's still plenty of room to believe that Jesus' ministry in the Gospels was done largely as a human in dependence on the Spirit, that we can do some of the things he did, and that the kingdom is a kingdom that is to be presented with power as well,
mm-hmm.
power over sin, over disease, and over the demonic.
And these represent attesting miracles as well, giving credibility to the message.
Absolutely do. And there's no reason why we couldn't grow in this.
Yeah, and it has nothing to do with gifting. I'm glad you emphasized that.
That's so irrelevant to me. It's not. I'm not interested.
So even if a person is a cessationist with regards to the gift, they shouldn't be a cessationist with regards to the Holy Spirit.
Well,
because the Spirit
didn't die when the Apostle John died.
That's right. Well, one thing that we've talked about before here and other places is the impact of the supernatural in winning people to Christ now, especially Muslims. In fact, ever since you brought this to my attention, every time I run into a Muslim who has become a Christian, a former Muslim who'd become a follower of Jesus Christ in their own country and in their environment, and I ran into one when I was in the Ukraine about 3 months ago.
Yeah.
It was in my class. I always ask them the nature of their testimony, and in this case in the Ukraine, and there's some others that I talked to, there was this supernatural element of things happening.
Greg, Listen, I'll bet you I've talked to 15 missionaries from different missions organizations about this. 6 weeks ago, I had dinner with Josh McDowell.
Mm-hmm.
He's been spending a ton of time in Muslim countries, and we're talking 4, 5, 6 different ones. He said to Hope and me, JP and Hope, I'm telling you, 8 or 9 out of 10 people who come to Jesus have had some kind of supernatural encounter,
mm-hmm.
where an angel's appeared to them, they've had a vision or dream where Jesus told them part of the gospel or the whole gospel. He said 10 to 20% are healings, physical healings.
Mm-hmm.
He said something is going on over there that's utterly unprecedented. And all I'm saying is that I don't think that's just for the mission field.
Mm-hmm.
And so may I just summarize this by saying that I'm very nuanced in the book. Because there's so much misunderstanding. Doctors are critical. I'm not against doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly believe that charismatic excesses and promising people they're going to get well and all that is just a sham. And I'm not for that. But I do believe that our religion is supernatural, and we can all learn to pray for the sick a little better, or learn to hear the Lord guide and direct and speak to us. We could open up to dreams a little bit more, and we have to be careful about that sort of thing, but God still speaks through dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to give dreams to Freud totally. I want to say that, no, I'm going to be very wise mm-hmm. if I have a dream, but on the other hand, I'm going to say, Lord, if this was from you, confirm it or give me further leading mm-hmm. on it, because I can't act on just one dream, but I mm-hmm. want to be open. That's mm-hmm. what I mean.
Well, we've got about 3 more minutes here before we have to go. Tell me, I'm sure there are a lot of people that are thinking, okay, that's all happening over there. I want to see something like that happening here.
Yeah.
What are some practical ways that we can, I'm speaking more in terms of the signs and wonders as opposed to the direction and guidance thing, because we've talked about this, we have different opinion on this, but this other area that we yeah. share.
Number one, start reading in this area with credible people that you can tell are credible, and I list some sources in the book. Number two.
In other words, if people are convinced this is actually happening over there, it increases their faith for
absolutely.
It to happen here.
Increases
okay.
your faith. Secondly, start in church asking people about this. I mean, I went to a big church and spoke to their staff of 50 people, and at the halftime, a guy told that one of the sound guys told me that he cracked his ribs and his fingers, and they'd x-rayed him. There were hairline fractures, and he went home, and eight people prayed over him, and he was healed, and he went back the next day, and they re-x-rayed him, and they were completely gone. He was mm-hmm. totally healed.
Mm.
The swelling in his hands went down before their eyes instantaneously, and I said, have you ever told anybody about this? And mm-hmm. he said, no, I don't like talking about myself. So, I mean, the point is that these things are happening in standard evangelical churches, but because we don't want to appear weird or gullible, we don't talk about them. So the second thing I would suggest is that people begin to interact with each other about their stories and say, have you ever seen an answer to prayer that was so specific it couldn't have been coincidence or placebo? Share it with me. We have to be more aggressive in pursuing one another to bear witness. So those are some things we can do, mm-hmm. and then I suggest some other things in the book.
Do you think that we, as kind of Americans, and therefore kind of following in an Enlightenment kind of framework, even though we are committed to the idea of the supernatural, that we have a predisposition to disbelieve and to find any other explanation but a supernatural one?
Absolutely, and that's why these things tend to happen more in other countries, because we tend not to have the kind of faith that finds this natural to mm-hmm. normal to us or easy for
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Jay, it's been really rich talking with you, as it usually is, and we are looking forward to next year. I hope it's not that long till I see you again, but we are looking forward to next year for our cruise in, is it July or August, Melinda? August.
I can't wait, Greg.
Yeah, it's going to be great, and you'll be teaching, and a lot of these things I'm sure will be a part of what you want to be talking about, and Josh McDowell will be there, and Sean McDowell, and I'll be there, and a whole bunch of other people, so we hope that people are thinking in advance about taking their holiday in August on a cruise to Alaska with all of us.
Listeners, I do hope that the people listening to the show now will write a check to support the radio broadcast, because this show is way too important to let it shut down, and we need people who listen to support it. If you benefit from something like this, if you believe in this kind of Christianity, you need to be a supporter of it, and I wasn't asked to say that. That's honestly what I believe.
Thank you so much, Jay, and for all the contribution you've made. All God's best to you.
You too, my friend. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dr. J.P. Moreland, the book is The Kingdom Triangle, Recover the Christian Mind, Renovate the Soul, Restore the Spirit's Power. As you heard me say, you know, Jay and I are not on the same you know, the same page with everything in the book, but most of those things we are, and we have friendly disagreements about the other things, and you guys can make your own decisions. But I wouldn't have him on if I didn't trust him, and didn't believe that he has a tremendous amount to offer you through the things that that he's written in this book. I think we have this available through Stand to Reason, do we, Melinda? She's on the phone, actually, with someone else. By the way, which reminds me, lines are now open for hour number two. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. And if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. And you can call me and get in the queue to talk to me next hour about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. In the meantime, the book Kingdom Triangle, Recover the Christian Mind, Renovate the Soul, Restore the Spirit's Power. I recommend it. And like I said, I think it's available through STR, if not Amazon or your local bookstore. All right, hour number two coming straight ahead. Stay with us. I think that's a new one, isn't it? That's good. I like that. All right. Greg Kokel here with our second hour this afternoon. I'm with you every Sunday, 3 until 5, for Clear Thinking Christianity. And lines are open here for you, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150 is the number. Some new talk about hate crime legislation on Capitol Hill. I guess the states have that already. This would be a federal version. So I'll be getting to your calls in just a moment. Let me say a word about this because this is in the news. Apparently, Senators Ted Kennedy, and who is a Democrat from Massachusetts, and Gordon Smith, who's a Republican from Oregon. That's an odd coupling. Have introduced the Matthew Shepard Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act. It's a mouthful. And attached it to the recent defense bill. I actually don't know what the status of that is right now, and I'm not I don't follow these things very much. The details are of much less interest to me than the ideas. So let me talk for a few moments with you about the ideas. I have written a piece on the question of hate crimes. It's posted at townhall.com, and you can go there if you'd like to read that. We also have it at Stand to Reason, sdr.org, and it's called Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime. And I have some reasons that I've expressed there. I'm going to give the summary of them to you right now. So in case you run into this, you will have at least something to say about it. This is one of those cases where it is very important for us not to react emotionally. And what I mean by that is, who is in favor of hate crimes? I'm not. Probably nobody is in principle. Even perpetrators of hate crimes probably aren't in favor of them in principle, but they overlook it when it's their turn or whatever, when they're the perps. But the point is, because one has concerns about hate crime legislation does not mean that they are soft on hate crimes. It may mean that they have thought more carefully about this issue than the rank and file who is responding with a knee-jerk reaction. And I am against hate crimes, and I'm also against hate crime legislation. And I have four very good reasons why I don't think this is good legislation. In fact, the first one is the most important. The other ones are big too, but this one seems to be obvious. Hate crime legislation criminalizes thought. They criminalize the thoughts, or in this case, the type of thought called a motive, the animus, what is driving apparently, and I got to underscore apparently, certain types, and I have to underscore certain types of assaults. And those are further weaknesses I'll get to in just a moment. But so there is a crime that is an assault that is aggravated by the attitude people think you have that motivates it, and that attitude gets a special punishment. That's the deal there. And since when do we start punishing motives? Even the distinction between first and second degree murder is not a distinction in which motives are punished. It's actions even in those cases. In the first case, you lie in wait and plan in advance to execute the murder, the crime. So that's additional action, and because of those additional actions, the crime is aggravated. When you kill somebody in a fit of emotion, there's no lying in wait, no advanced planning. So it's a different crime, and there's a different punishment. There's no punishment for attitudes there. So where do we get off punishing people for the thoughts in their minds? I mean, that in itself should be enough. As Melinda Penner pointed out at our staff meeting the other day, that, you know, the liberals are quick to say the government shouldn't be in our bedroom. But apparently they're fine with it, the government being in our minds. How does the government know what we're thinking? And why should any thought be criminalized? Hate crime legislation criminalizes thought, not conduct. The assault is already punishable under existing statutes. But hate crime legislation levies additional penalties solely for the attitude of the heart, a motive called hate. And this is a recent development, isn't it? Because the law has been completely uninterested in penalizing motive. Whether somebody is driven to commit a crime by greed or malice or love or hate was irrelevant. The conduct is what mattered, and that's what got punished. And I think this is why Alan Keyes says of hate crime legislation, at the end of the day, government can govern men's actions. It cannot govern their hearts. And when it attempts to govern their hearts, this is simply an excuse for the worst kind of tyranny. So the first problem with hate crime legislation is it makes thoughts illegal and actionable. Now, this leads to the second problem, which should be obvious. How do you know what a person is thinking? How do you really know? Have you ever been really, really mad at somebody who's your friend and you got in a fight and you said something really mean to them? Does this mean that you hate them? Does this mean, what if your friend had a brace and you called him a Crip because you were mad? Does this mean that you have hatred towards crippled people or handicapped people? No, it means that you were mad at your friend and you were trying to find a way to get back at him. But see, that borders on hate crime. So the problem here is, how do you know when you are actually guilty of hate such that you can punish the hate, when sometimes it's just a burst of emotion? I heard somebody, it was a few years now, but they got in an argument with somebody in a store, you know, it was like a 7-Eleven or something. And so they took the slushy after, you know, they got this whole thing escalated, and they threw the icy slushy into the person's face. Now, that's an assault. But they used a kind of racial slur when they did it. Now, that is a hate crime. Can you imagine now? Just because they said this thing, that doesn't mean that they actually hate the person. It doesn't mean that they hate the race. It just means they were mad and they lost their temper. Yet that becomes actionable as a hate crime. And so how do you know what a person really feels? Sometimes a person may be hateful. Sometimes they were. What the point I'm making here is this does not actually punish hate. And in fact, this is the third problem, it doesn't, in addition to the fact that you can't divine accurately a person's motive, you must infer it from what they say, and this is terribly misleading. Hate crime legislation does not penalize all hate. It only penalizes hate of a particular kind. Hate that seems associated with race, religion, or in the case of the hate crime expansion legislation, I think that Ted Kennedy and Gordon Smith are trying to have attached to the federal bill, hate and he put hate in quotes here, hate for sexual preference. So that's the kind of hate that's penalized. I mean, if I was telling my mother-in-law, who's 88 years old, I said, Mom, if I beat you up and called you a flea-bitten old bag when I did it, then I'd be charged with assault, as I should be. But if you're a lesbian and I called you a flea-bitten old lesbian, I'd be charged with the same assault and extra punishment for hate crime violation. So why should the lesbian get more protection than you get when the only difference is in what I thought, apparently, about the lesbian and that she's a lesbian, and no difference in the assault? And so this ends up creating a certain class of protected citizens. And therefore, you have an equal protection problem. Some people are protected more than others in virtue of the aggravated punishment for attacking them, if one can infer from it, whether accurately or not, that you were motivated by hate. And certainly if you say something that relates to their sexual preference, their ethnicity, or their religion, you're done for. It's all over. Now, here's the last problem. And the last problem is there is a very thin line between hate crimes and hate speech. And both of those hates are in quotes. Once you criminalize the thought, then what's going to happen when you talk about those protected classes in ways that are disparaging? Because now they have special protection. And if you speak in a disparaging way about them, it can be one could suggest that you are fomenting the hate crimes with the hate speech, and so the hate speech becomes actionable. You think I'm making this up? This is exactly what has happened in Canada. And for those who have been asked about this, with regards to the bill right now that is authored by Ted Kennedy and Gordon Smith, apparently under the law, a pastor could be charged with the crime of incitement if he preached against homosexuality and a person in the congregation left the church and committed a crime against a homosexual. Then, now what? Now we got hate speech that's actionable. And now you can't say what you need to say or you want to say. Even if what you want to say is nasty and crude and impolite or in bad taste or whatever, why should you be punished for saying it? Don't we have an amendment that guards that? So these are all bad things about hate crime legislation. Hate crime legislation is a bad idea. If you want more detail on that at our website, Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime. And I give the details there. All right, time to go to callers, and let's go to Tallahassee. Is that Tallahassee, Florida? Yeah. Okay, let's go to Brandon in Tallahassee. Hello, Brandon.
Hello, Greg.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What's on your mind?
I just want to say it first, man. I've taken all your ambassador programs. They are fantastic.
That's good. Thanks. I appreciate that.
They're great.
Good.
Let's see here. I got a friend of mine. My best friend is, he's a geologist,
mm-hmm.
and he, you know, teaches evolution in class and everything like that, and mm-hmm. I started talking with him last January about some of the stuff, and, you know, one of his biggest objections was, you know, first of all, he said, you know, you need to be real careful with religion, and I was like, you know, what? But he's real concerned about that, and then he starts talking to me about...
You got to be real careful with materialism, too, you know, that's a kind of...
No.
Yeah, so, okay, go ahead.
But, he says, you know, the Bible, you know, basically gives a timeline of 6,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was, you know, either way for me, I could say there's a lot of evidence for a young Earth. And at the same time, you know, I don't have any problem with Big Bang cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the approach is basically he thinks there's, you know, errors in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
That's a main objection from him.
Well, this is something that consistently... It's common for somebody from his discipline to say, especially as it touches the age of the earth issue. And if one asserts that the Bible teaches that the earth is 6,000 years old, I can see how he's going to have a problem with that if he's a geologist. But the Bible does not teach that. That is a conclusion, and I'm choosing my words carefully here, Brandon, but the Bible doesn't say the earth is, you know, was created on this date, and so then we can just, you know, measure it. There are ways that people understand the book of Genesis that allows them to come to the conclusion that the earth is maybe 6 to 10,000 years old, and there's a line of reasoning there that has merit. But the Bible doesn't teach that. That is a line of reasoning that some people follow to come to that conclusion. But there is another side of things, the argument that the scriptures do not in fact teach that, that there's flexibility there, and that the age of the earth is not an essential part of any biblical teaching. And for myself, I'm convinced from the geological record and other things that the earth is much older than 6,000 years. Now, I could be mistaken about that, you know, and I know there's debate among in Christian circles, but it presents a tactical advantage to me when talking to people like your friend, because I could say, well, the Bible doesn't teach that. It may be true, a true inference from the scriptures, but the Bible doesn't teach that. In fact, there are a lot of people who don't think the Bible teaches that at all and believe in an ancient universe. So if you're trying to pin that as a fixed thing on the Bible, then that's a straw man. That's a misrepresentation of Christianity. He's rejecting something that is not really a fixed part of the program, at least from my perspective. And young earthers are much more dogmatic on that. And if they're going to be more dogmatic on that, then they've got to face this much more aggressive challenge. Because I think for your geologist friend to admit that the earth is only 10,000 years old is basically, in his mind, probably to admit that the earth is flat and the moon is made out of green cheese. They're all in the same category. And do you notice how, since he's now got to jump through the hoop of a 6,000-year-old earth, before he gets to the gospel, he's never even going to get to a reasonable consideration of the gospel? Do you see that?
Yeah, that was my biggest thing I couldn't come up with.
Yeah, now what's he stumbling over? He's not stumbling over the cross. He's stumbling over a 6,000-year-old earth.
Yeah.
That's not the right thing to stumble over, you know. I try to tell people, you know, Christianity is difficult or offensive enough. Don't make it harder. The gospel by itself is plenty hard. So let's not complicate when we're witnessing and talking to people, let's not overcomplicate things. Not that you are, but the damage has already been done with this guy. Overcomplicate it by making him jump through a bunch of, hoops about the age of the earth and about creationism and about, your particular peculiar view of second coming of Christ or whatever. Let's just start from the beginning and look at the basics and then work on that and resolve those other things later. Even the evolution question, which I think is really a problem. Now, once what I mean is the evolution question is a genuine problem for Christianity, but it also gets in the way of people giving consideration to Christianity if they're forced to jump through the hoop first of some kind of intelligent design. The difficulty is when you have people that have these things already in place in their mind, and you talk to this guy and you realize, oh, he's already got a problem. So now how do I remove that barrier? And the first thing that I do with regards to the 6,000-year-old earth is to say, look, there is a legitimate debate within Christianity about that issue. And you do not have to believe, and this is what I'd emphasize to him, you do not have to believe in a young earth to be able to take the teachings of Jesus and the New Testament seriously. It's not built into the program. It's a non-issue in the New Testament. There aren't discussions about the age of the universe. Now, there are discussions about God being the creator of Adam and Eve and stuff like that, but don't bring that up unless you have to. I would try to remove this stumbling block first and then try to deal with the other issues. And this is where the whole intelligent design discussion may come in, because a lot of the intelligent design discussion has to do with the fine-tuned constants of the universe and doesn't address the evolution issue at all. And I'm thinking of the DVD, Privileged Planet. Are you familiar with this, Brandon? Pardon me?
I'm about to send that to him. He said he'd be happy to look at it for me.
Oh, yeah, that's an excellent...
I don't know too much. You tell me what you think.
Pardon me?
He said, cool, look at it.
Okay, good. And this is an excellent treatment because it doesn't deal with – it doesn't take on the age of the universe. It doesn't promote a younger universe. And it doesn't even – that one doesn't even go after evolution. Now, I know the guys who made it, and Jay Richards is one of them, and he's the author of the book – one of the authors of the book by that title. So he's not an evolutionist. But what he does is he gives evidence that's very, very powerful for the existence of God, to kind of put a crack, you know, in the facade here, in the resistance. And once that crack is in, it starts widening. Then I think people become more open to some of these other things that they would never have countenanced before. So I think telling your friend, look, you don't have to believe in a young earth to take the teachings of Jesus seriously, one. And secondly, let me give you a piece that is done by scientists, and these people know their stuff, scientists and philosophers of science. And you tell me what you think about it, because the evidence here, I think, is very compelling. It's certainly going to give you something to think about. So we can talk about it later. And just make kind of a modest appeal to him. Give him the DVD and let that very wonderful DVD do its work. Thanks. Sound like a plan?
That sounds great.
Okay, Brandon. Give us a call in a couple months when you after you've had your conversation, whenever, and let us know how it went, all right?
Thanks, Greg.
Okay, you're welcome. 1-800-227-5278. Let's take a break, and we'll come back to your calls here on Stand to Reason.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador, and to open up the riches of truth in new ways, and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
All right, Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every weekend, Sundays, 3 until 5. And if you've lost your mind, you can find it here at Stand to Reason, and you find my mind. I mean, all the minds are kind of hanging out here. This is the place for minds to be, I guess. Let's see. I got it. I almost forgot my announcement here. My congratulations and kudos to Amanda Williams of Nashville, Tennessee. She is our Frapper winner here. That means that we pulled her name out of our hat, as it were. Do we actually have a hat? How do we actually? It must be some kind of like a, you know, like computer raffle thing. I don't know. They must do it electronically. But everyone who is registered on our website, where you go for the podcast. So you go to the podcast icon on the lower left-hand side of our homepage, and you punch that, and then you go to a place where you can register for the podcast and mark on a map, the Frapper map, where you live, that you're, and acknowledge that you're part of our listening community. And then we, from that list of names, we draw, figuratively speaking, names, and send a free gift, a relativism book, tactics, something like that. And Amanda Williams of Nashville, Tennessee is our lucky, I guess we'd have to say recipient, not really winner. It's not a contest, but she gets this nice gift. So if you would like to be included and identify yourself as part of our listening community, then go to our website, lower left-hand corner, punch the icon there for podcast, and register with the Frapper map. And once again, Amanda, congratulations. Now, Maureen in Chicago. Maureen, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Yes, thank you.
Did you know that I'm from Chicago, Maureen?
Yes, I've heard that.
Oh, yeah. Where in Chicago are you?
North Side, city of Chicago near Wrigley Field.
Oh, I'm Rogers Park. That was like a long time ago, half a century ago, but 1950s, I was in Rogers Park. You know, you could hear the Wrigley Field cheering. So I was a Cubby fan right there on Rogers Avenue across from Pottawatomie Park. So then we moved to the northwest suburbs, you know, Des Plaines area, Prospect Heights, Mount Prospect. And then I ended up going to high school in Elmhurst. So you know all those places. So. Okay, Maureen, what's on your mind today?
My question is, how do you deal with the argument that Islam and Christianity are equally violent, or even after you point out the foundational teachings of both religions and compare them,
mm-hmm.
And even after you point out what's going on in the news every day, that it's not
right
Christians doing these types of things.
Okay, two thoughts here, Maureen. One of them is that the way you stated it was, how do you deal with the argument that? Well, this isn't an argument. This is an assertion. Do you know the difference?
I'm not sure.
Okay, an assertion is just a point of view that somebody says it's so. An argument is a point of view that's buttressed by reasons. If I just said Socrates is mortal, that would be a, you know, Socrates, the philosopher.
Yes.
That he's a mortal man. He was a mortal man. Well, that would be an assertion. And I say, well, how do you know that? What's the argument? And you say, well, all men are mortal, and Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Do you see how the second now is a line of reasoning that allows you to conclude that Socrates is mortal? And then you might look at the line of reasoning to see if it really worked or not. But that's the difference between an assertion and an argument.
And that's exactly the problem that I have, because I do try to bring up the, you know, the facts of what each religion teaches.
Right. Okay, let me suggest, I just want to suggest an easier way for you in this circumstance. So somebody says to you that Christianity and Islam are equally violent. And then I say, well, that's it surprises me. Why would you think that? Okay, notice how I've acknowledged their point of view, but I haven't acted as if their point of view has any merit just because they've said it. And if I start giving all the reasons why they're wrong, I'm kind of almost acknowledging that they've made a good point. Now I have to defeat it. You don't refute assertions. You refute arguments. In the case of an assertion, it's their job to defend. It's not your job to refute. So before I'm going to take any responsibility to try to defeat that point of view, I'm going to ask them, give me some reasons why you would think that Christianity and Islam are equally violent. And so then I want to hear what they have to say. And then when they start giving reasons, then I will have particular things to deal with. And they'll say, well, the Crusades. Okay, that comes up, right? I'll say, how long ago were the Crusades? Oh, 1,000 years ago. Do you think that's a fair comparison to talk about what Crusades did, some Christians did 1,000 years ago? I mean, that may be one line of response, okay? That was 1,000 years ago. You mean you have to go 1,000 years back to find examples of systematic Christian violence? And that appeals to you? I mean, this persuades you that they're pretty much the same? Secondly, do you know what the here's what I would say in the case of the Crusades. What were the Crusades about? The Crusades were about Christians going to liberate the Holy Land from the attack of Muslims who were destroying Christians. I mean, that's how they started. No, I don't want to defend the Crusades. I mean, that's not the big deal. But the bigger question is, what teachings of Jesus or the New Testament taught that something like Crusades are legitimate? Well, there is no teaching. Jesus, you know, the early church for 300 years was pacifist. They wouldn't fight anybody. They wouldn't even defend themselves. They wanted to die, a lot of them. They wanted to be martyrs. Okay, so my response is first is to make them defend their own statements. I want to hear some reasons, and they better be good for me to be persuaded that they're basically the same. But all one has to do is, and then you look at, well, what did Muhammad, Jesus teach and do, and what did Muhammad teach and do? And what did his immediate followers do? In the case of Jesus, he didn't teach violence. He didn't do violence. And his immediate followers didn't do violence. In the case of Islam, Muhammad taught violence. He did violence. His immediate followers did violence. And all his followers and his followers characteristically ever since then have done violence. So how can you say there's parity? There's equality between the two. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah, maybe that's the way of going about it, asking them first to give their reasons why.
Yes.
I'd like to bring up...
That's always the first way to go, because you don't want to accept burden of responsibility, the burden of proof on your shoulders when they're the ones who are making the claim. All right?
Okay, yeah, they also like to bring up abortion doctors, which, you know, how often does that happen?
Okay, yeah, how many abortion doctors have been murdered? Oh, this is such a ridiculous, stupid red herring.
I know.
This is how many abortion doctors have been murdered? Three? Okay. How many Christians in the United States? Like millions? How many Christians approved? Tell me what Christian tradition teaches it's okay to kill people. None. But there are thousands upon thousands of people who have died. I'm talking thousands upon thousands of people who have died at the hands of Muslims in virtue of Islam, the teaching of Islam.
Exactly.
Not just Muslims who are wacko. And it's fair to say, look, there are wackos in every kind of group that do stupid things. Here you got like three. All right? And you've got millions, and everybody else completely condemned them. So how is that parallel? See, notice the question there. So we had a few abortionist doctors killed. Everybody else completely condemned them. Their killing of abortionists didn't fall within any Christian tradition teaching. And Muslims have killed thousands upon thousands upon thousands in terrorist acts around the world. And it is consistent with at least one strain of religious thinking that is a respected tradition all over the world. In other words, it's a legitimate, respected tradition in Islam, and it comes directly from their teachings. Now, I'm not saying that all Muslims believe that, but it is a school of thought. There is no school of thought in Christianity that says it's okay to kill abortion doctors. And, this is where I want to say, you're not being serious. You're not being serious that you think that the death of abortion doctors who claim to be Christians is the same as all of the terrorism done by Muslims who claim to be Muslims, and that means that they're both equally violent? Are you kidding me? Haven't you given any thought to this? I mean, this kind of stuff is silly that people say this.
Well, yeah, it's the argument that I hear all the time, so maybe that will be the way to go about
okay.
it.
Just, you arm yourself with...
To give their reasons... Why first before I?
Yeah, that's the first one. Exactly right. Exactly right. And then they might say, well, what about abortion? And you say, okay, tell me what doctrine of Christianity teaches that people should kill abortion doctors? None. That's why it never happens in terms of irregularity. That when they do happen, it's really weird and everybody condemns it. But tell me the tradition. That says you should kill infidels, like Wahhabism and a whole massive portion of Islam. And this is why if you change your religion in any country that is ruled by Sharia, that you lose your life. You see, they're still killing them.
for religious reasons. Yeah, how can anybody make – no intelligent person can make this – make a comparison like that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but they do all the time.
Well, I mean, there's no way – look, they can say stupid things, and there's no way you can stop them from doing that. But I think you can ask these questions. Just say, well, I just you're imagining things if you think that there's any similarity between these two. So how many of your Christian friends do you fear? How many do you fear for your life with any of your Christian friends? When was the last time a Christian sawed off the head of some person on videotape and then passed it out? When does that happen? I mean, this is silly. It's just absolutely silly. Shame on those people who did violence in the name of Christianity, but that doesn't mean that they have anything to do with Christianity. But the people who do that violence in the name of Islam, they tell you why they're doing it. It's because of Islam. And that's what Muhammad did and his followers. And that's why the whole world, you know, within 100 years after the death of Muhammad, the whole Mediterranean region was Muslim. It wasn't because of the gospel of love of Muhammad. It's because of the sword of Muhammad, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Maureen.
All right, thank you.
Okay, good talking to you. Unbelievable. You know, I've got my one word answer to that challenge. And this is, you know, I've used this quite effectively, actually. And here's the one word. It's actually a date. 732. What's that? That's the Battle of Tours. 100 years after Muhammad died, he's born 575, died 632. 100 years later, Charles Martel finally stops the advance of the Muslim armies in France. And if he hadn't done that, you and I'd be speaking Arabic. What does that tell you? That tells you that for 100 years, there was nothing but warfare by Muslims to capture the whole world. Where'd that come from? That came from their founder. Peaceful religion. Okay. Let's go to Sam in Iowa. Sam, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. I called last week and we talked a little bit. I have read the chapter on the Spirit by J.P. Molin, and I'm from India. I've heard a lot about, and I've seen, you know, about the Spirit's work. I want to ask, what do you make of modern-day prophets and apostles?
Well, I don't have any reason to believe that there are any modern-day apostles if we understand apostles to be a unique office that has the authority to speak for God in the way that the 12 apostles did. Well, the 12 is kind of a round number because the 12 included Judas, and he was gone, and then Paul got added, and I think Apollos was identified as apostle, but there were a handful of them, and there weren't many. And there is no indication that apostles, if one understands the apostolic office as having a certain kind of unique authority of the early apostles, there is no indication that that apostolic role has continued on. I know there are people that have claimed this. These people start cults and then they disappear. Take a whole lot of people down the flea-bitten path and then they're gone. So there's no longevity to them. They just create a problem. I don't have any reason to believe that there are apostles like that. Now, apostolos is a Greek word that simply means sent out ones, those that are sent out. And in that sense, I mean, a missionary would be an apostolos in that regard. But usually when people say, yeah, we've got apostles in our church, these are the ones that get to speak for God. Like in the LDS, the Mormon Church, mm-hmm. They have their apostles, and they speak for God. They have final authority, okay? I have no reason to believe that anything like that is still going on today. Now, if what you mean by a prophet is somebody who has a unique gift to speak for God supernaturally, so there's this fourth telling, this declaration of God's words, I don't have any difficulty in principle with that. Now, I spent 8 years as a staff pastor at a Pentecostal church, 25 years total I was in that church, and I heard prophecies there, lots of them, at different times. I don't know if I ever heard the real McCoy. I think that most of the times people speak, thus saith the Lord, prophetically for the Lord, that they're just speaking off the top of their head. They may be well-meaning, but I don't have any good reason to believe that most of those people were speaking anything legitimate from God. So I am not against the gifts from theological perspective. I'm open to them in principle, but I think that most prophecies that are uttered by people are just sentimental feelings of the people speaking. And if you think about
when you're in a church and you hear a prophecy, it's kind of amazing how shallow they are. They're well-meaning, but they don't really say much. Sometimes they're quoting a verse. Well, it's already been said, you know, and not that you can't say it again, but it seems odd that God, that this would be a prophecy. And the scripture says that we're to test the prophets. We're to see whether they're from God, you know, and if people, if the prophets aren't 100% on everything they claim, they're not real prophets. That's it. Because prophecy is a revelatory gift and God doesn't get his revelations wrong. Man can't get in the way of that. God underwrites those things when they're genuine. So man can't make mistakes on prophecies. So, I mean, that's my difference with J.P. Moreland is not on the question of whether or not they're prophets or prophecies. I don't think that he believes in apostles in the ultimate sense. I've never heard him say that. But the difference that we have is whether the right way to get guidance is to get personalized messages from God, each Christian, to hear the voice of God for himself. That's the place we differ.
Okay.
And yeah, on that issue, I don't find biblical support. Go ahead. What?
Yeah, Moreland, in the chapter, he just mentioned about prophetic words, and I've had people, you know, tell those things to me. How would we know then? Do you know of any way to say, okay, this guy is saying this is a prophecy? How can we check for anything but wait till the future plays out? And
well, here's what I would say. If somebody offers a prophecy to me and they're speaking as a prophet, here's my question. Why should I believe that you are speaking accurately for God? Now, okay. What often happens in these situations where somebody else gives an alleged prophecy, and I'm going to have to go in a minute because I have a break. But it's the burden, the implicit burden of proof is always on the person who is receiving the prophecy. The prophet, the self-proclaimed prophet, gives the so-called prophecy. And because this would be my assessment of it, because he is standing in the spiritual position, he's the spiritual person, he doesn't feel the need to justify his prophecy. He feels like, well, I'm speaking for God. If you don't like it, lump it. You know, and if you think I'm wrong, prove me wrong. But it's just the other way around. The person who's making this extraordinary claim that God is in fact speaking through them has the obligation, it seems to me, to give you good reason to pay attention to them. And the prophets of the Old Testament would give short-term prophecies along with long-term prophecies so they'd work signs and wonders to demonstrate that the prophetic mantle was on their shoulders, that you should take them seriously. Even Samuel, you read in 2 Samuel or 1 Samuel chapter 3, I believe. And you see there when Samuel the prophet was called, even though he was young, it says at the end of the chapter that no words of Samuel fell to the ground, but all were fulfilled. That means he didn't get it wrong. And then it says below it, thus he was confirmed as a prophet of God, of Israel. So anybody who claims to have a prophetic word for you, it is legitimate to say, to ask, well, why should I believe you? Why should I think you're speaking for God? If they cannot give you a good answer, you can ignore them. You might want to keep your, you know, be alert to whatever they said and to see if it comes true. But if it doesn't come true, you know, it's nothing. These people are spurious. They're speaking off the top of their head, presumptuously, and if this was the theocracy, they'd be dead.
Okay. I have one more question, but do we have to...
Okay, hold. You know, I've got some other callers, I think, that I have to get to. But, you know, Sam, next week I'd be glad to talk to you again if you want to make it. You can call every week. It's all right.
All right.
Okay, buddy. And we'll talk some more about this because this is an important issue. All right?
All right. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate the call, too. This is important. And I am troubled. I understand there's controversy about this and people have different opinions than me. But it certainly is reasonable for us to say when someone offers an alleged prophetic word, why should I believe that? Why should I think that you're actually speaking for God and not something else going on here? That's fully legitimate. And if they can't give you a good answer, you just completely ignore them. There's all kinds of nonsense going on, and I think this is an example of it. All right, 1-800-227-5278. The program is Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel.
Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Mind implants without brain surgery performed here every weekend, ladies and gentlemen. On Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, chief surgeon. And let's quickly go. We got room in the lines, 1-800-227-5278. Let's go out to Oklahoma and Rusty. Hello, Rusty. Greg Kokel.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great. I have been doing this thought experiment for a couple of years now, and I just wanted to run it by you. I guess last week a guy called about the Holy Spirit, and it kind of jogged my memory about this. So I just wanted to see what you thought about it, how biblical it was and everything. It's basically an analogy about the Trinity, and I've never heard it before, and so that's kind of why I wanted to call and see. We'll have Frank will be our character in this analogy, and he'll represent God.
Okay.
We have Frank, and then Frank wants to basically pass on his knowledge or be able to communicate in a way that we understand better. So Frank writes a journal every day, and this journal would represent Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So we can read this journal and we can understand who Frank is and get information about Frank based on his journal.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's say Frank goes away and we come across his journal and we read his journal every day. So we understand what Frank is trying to tell us, the information he's trying to pass along to us, everything that he wants us to know, and we can know Frank
mm-hmm.
through this journal. Well, the journal always existed in Frank because essentially it's the same way as us. If we wrote a journal, it always existed inside us, but it didn't manifest itself until we put it on paper. It didn't physically manifest itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I really like what Frank has to say in his journal, so I go about my daily life this way, and this would be what I would call the spirit of Frank. So basically you have the Holy Spirit of Frank. And the way I would define the spirit, I guess this is kind of what the caller was asking last time, was spirit would be, I guess, the knowledge, capital T, capital K. I mean, it would just be, I can't really put it into one word or
mm-hmm.
simple phrase, but it is just like the understanding, what we know Frank would have us do.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the spirit is just a knowledge, you know, but it's the knowledge, it's the most important knowledge
mm-hmm.
that we can ever possess.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can see that the spirit always existed inside of Frank because he wrote it in the journal and was always a part of him. So now you have all three parts of the Trinity existing simultaneously forever, you know, and they've always existed inside of Frank, but they're three separate, distinct parts.
Okay. Let me respond to this. This is very creative. That's great if you're an artist, but it's not really good if you're doing theology.
Okay.
There are some things that you've captured about Trinity in this illustration, the fact that there are some things that are distinct, but each is in the other. Although, strictly speaking, the way you have it is that the journal and the spirit are in Frank. Mm-hmm. And so Frank is preeminent, and the others are subordinate to it as parts of Frank. And so Frank is the unified whole, which has these other profound things that are somehow in him.
Yes.
Okay? That is very different from the Trinitarian relationship. And now, does Frank's journal talk to Frank?
No, see, I...
I just want to ask a couple of questions okay. in a row here, because Frank's journal doesn't talk to Frank. Does it submit to Frank?
Yes.
The journal submits to Frank?
Well, I mean, the journal can't literally submit to Frank.
Okay, does it have a will?
No.
Then it can't submit to him.
No.
Okay, it's dependent upon him, but only in the sense that a person's thoughts are dependent on the thinker.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not submissive to that thinker, okay? And, well, these are the problems that you have when you try to use an illustration like this to communicate the Trinity, because these things, the journal and the so-called spirit of Frank, which is kind of we couldn't say the personification of knowledge, but we want to just say that it's the knowledge in action, not just propositional form in the journal, but it's the knowledge in action. These bear no resemblance to the personages of this of Jesus and the Spirit, because Jesus is a person, and the Father is a person, and the Spirit is a person, and they interact in personal ways. The Spirit prays for us. Jesus submits to the Father. He talks to the Father. We can lie to the Spirit. The Spirit leads us. It produces fruit in us. These are all, well, maybe not production of fruit so much, but all of these others are uniquely personal qualities
mm-hmm.
that are qualities only of persons. And so when you try to characterize them by metaphor with something that's really abstract and impersonal, you're not even close to the characterization that's appropriate.
I had another one. It's the same thing, but in a different form. Basically, would be you have a computer programmer. Someone that writes a Sims program, basically,
yeah,
and basically writes a character which is a person which can interact, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, but the person, even in a Sim program, is not interacting. What they are doing is reacting to your computer keystrokes, and in a way that's fun to play a game, but it's not an interaction. They don't have a self that is initiating. Acts of will towards you as the player in the game or something.
Well, no.
I lost you. Where'd you go, Rusty? You still there?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
That's really what I was saying. I was saying that, I mean, you know, God in his infinite wisdom, basically, he could sim that did have interaction and that would, you know, have a will, et cetera, et cetera. But so in...
Yeah, those are called human beings.
What's that?
Those are called human beings.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what I'm saying is that's the only way that I could illustrate it, because you know the ice and the
water and all that doesn't work. But see, this
never worked for me.
Well, it didn't work theologically either, because that's a good illustration. The idea that water can be in three forms.
Yeah.
There's my little Annabeth Noel just came in. Hi, honey. She's just waving at me. Okay. Sorry about that distraction. Just a beautiful little redhead just went by, and I just was fixated for a second. I'm glad they just shut up. Okay. Never mind. That's just a personal thing. But the water, liquid, solid, ice, and steam are three different ways that ice, or rather H2O, can express itself. That's not a description of the Trinity. That's a description of the heretical notion called modalism, you know.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to – this is the problem with all these illustrations. And I would say even that heretical illustration, or the illustration of the heresy, is actually more on target than what you've described to me. I wouldn't try to find all these artsy kind of illustrations. I would just describe it in a sense, propositionally, because that's all we can do. We have to say there is only one God. We know that's true. We know the Bible says that. We know that Jesus and the Father and the Spirit are personal beings, are persons, not personal beings, but they're persons, and they are personally distinct from each other, but they are all the one God. That's the Trinity, and you can't make it any more simple than that. It's simple and profound at the same time. And when we try to come up with a lot of these kinds of illustrations, we just muck it up. Really, my recommendation is completely stay away from the illustrations.
Well, I guess I was trying to just get it, you know, whenever I have the people that are Buddhists or Hindus, and they ask, you know, like they think that we're pantheists, and I'm just like, no,
we're not. But it's,
I can't come up with any illustration. I mean, if I try to tell them what you just said, it doesn't make any sense to them.
Here's an illustration.
Okay,
I'll give you an illustration. Now, with my caveat that I don't like these because I think this is a revealed doctrine, and we don't believe it because we can picture it in our mind. But picture a cube. Okay, the cube is three dimensions: height, width, and depth. Each dimension completely circumscribes the other dimensions. All of the height captures all of the all of the stuff of the cube. All of the depth captures all of the stuff of the cube. All of the width, the same thing. But they are distinct dimensions, but they subsume the entire thing. So if you have a two-dimensional item, it has no volume at all. It's gone. It disappears. It's just a. You can think of it in your mind, but it's not. A real thing. And if you took the height away, if you took the depth away, it would disappear. So you want to know, if you demand an illustration, there is a very simple illustration where you have one thing that from different facets you see these different elements that capture the whole thing. But, of course, none of these dimensions are personal, so it doesn't really capture the Trinity. But what it shows you is how three and one can be related in such a way that each is the whole.
Yes.
But they are distinct.
All right, well, thanks.
Okay, good talking to you, Rusty. And
you too.
I apologize. Oh, what happened to John Paul from Cummings, Georgia? Oh, we got 1 minute. So, okay, well, good. Then I'll just close with this thought. I don't like illustrations. And see, I just kind of violated my rule, but that's because Rusty really wanted something, and he wasn't doing too good being creative. So I just give him the simple thing. I don't like the illustrations because the illustrations suggest that we ought to believe in the Trinity because we can picture it in our mind. Oh, okay, I'll believe that now because now I can picture it. But that isn't why we believe it. We believe it because it's something revealed about God. Is it weird? Yes, it's weird. And how does it work? I don't know. It's a mystery. But it's not a contradiction. It's just weird. And we take it based on God's self-revelation. We trust him with that, and that's why we believe it, not because we can make a picture out of it. But if you got to use one, there's the best one that I've ever thought of. All right, friends, that's the music. That's the time. I'll be back next week with more careful, clear-thinking Christianity. In the meantime, use your minds. Be a good ambassador for Christ, and put a stone in their shoe. Give them something worth thinking about. I'm Greg Kokel. Go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye, friends.